Him, my friends, and other family members arrived. My friend Joao also came from Rio with a sack full of cash. He went to the stadium with an assistant who had a notebook and announced loudly, "I've got money to put on the kid from Rio. I want to bet on the little one. Any takers?" He got a lot of action because King Zulu was undefeated and so much bigger than me. People were practically lining up to place their bets with Joao. On the night of the fight, I was stretching in my dressing room with my back to the door when, suddenly, everyone looked toward the door as if a ghost were standing behind me. I felt King Zulu's presence, his looming shadow, but knew that he was trying to rattle me, so I paid no attention to him. Instead, I noticed that the air in Brasilia seemed drier than the air in Rio. I remained focused and waited for him to leave. I knew I was ready. When I finally made my way to the ring, I was struck by the noise. Brazilian sports fans are emotional. I remember someone shouting, "Kill the kid!" I entered the old canvas boxing ring first, because King Zulu was already famous, and I was just an unknown challenger from Rio. When my opponent got into the ring, he made strange, ugly faces at me and jumped around like a lunatic. This really revved up the crowd. They thought they were about to watch a lamb get fed to a lion. The bell rang, and King Zulu charged across the canvas ring. I held my ground until the last second and threw a brutal knee to his face as he tackled me. Although he took me down, I was sure that I had knocked him out and was thinking about how I would celebrate my first professional victory. Imagine my surprise when King Zulu stood up, shook his head, spat out teeth and blood, and charged again. When we clinched and started to grapple in the middle of the ring, he put his hand between my legs. I knew that he was trying to set up his trademark throw, so I wrapped my leg around one of his so that he couldn't get me off the ground. Then he put his back to the ropes, disentangled my leg, the only thing preventing him from throwing me, and lifted me so high over his head that the bottoms of my feet faced the ceiling. I was now going headfirst toward the concrete ring apron, and the drop was at least 8 feet. At the last instant, I was able to grab the top rope, swing my legs underneath me, and land on my feet. I climbed back into the ring, resumed fighting, and finally took him down. When I took his back, I held one of his wrists and elbowed him in the neck. King Zulu was so strong that he crawled out of the ring with me on his back. I was in shock when the first round ended. I had thrown everything I had at King Zulu, and he was still charging me like an angry bull. I felt I was running out of both gas and options. I got scared. It was like I was looking at a big river that I needed to cross. Instead of carefully wading in and testing the depth and strength of the current, my mind started telling me, "The other side is too far. The water is too deep. The current is too strong. You can't make it." I was trying to quit before I had even tried to cross the river. It wasn't until after the fight that I realized how my negative mindset had intoxicated and filled me with fear and doubt. When I returned to my corner covered in Zulu's blood, I wondered if it was even possible to hurt this monster. "Throw in the towel. I'm dead," I said to my dad. At first, Elio just ignored me, then said, "You're doing great. He's more tired than you are." When I said, "No, Dad, I'm serious," he cut me off and said, "No, he's in much worse shape than you. You're going to kick his ass." We started arguing, and then Holes dumped a bucket full of ice and water on my head. That shocked me back to my senses, and as I was gasping for breath, the bell rang. The thought of quitting vanished from my mind as I stepped toward King Zulu. I realized that I had only two options, kill or die. There was no other way. We were both tired, so the pace of the second round was much slower and less intense. King Zulu threw a big punch that I ducked, then I got him in a clinch. I tried to throw him, and even though I couldn't, it began to dawn on me that my dad was right. King Zulu was more tired than I was. When the crowd saw that the kid from Rio was still standing toe-to-toe with this killer, the momentum shifted in my direction. Everyone loves an underdog, and now people were yelling, "Come on, kid! You can do it!" After struggling for a bit on our feet, I eventually wrestled King Zulu to the ground, immediately took his back, and began to elbow him in the head and back of the neck. Then I sunk a choke, and what had been hell just 3 minutes before turned to pure bliss. When I won, the crowd was stunned. Moments after my win, Zulu hugged me and said, "Kid, congratulations, but you've got all that help, and I'm a self-made fighter." I hugged him back and thanked him for the opportunity to fight. My friend and advisor, Sergio Zveiter, had also come to Brasilia to support me. Prior to the fight, he'd had some doubts that he did not express until later. After I won, Sergio was overjoyed, not because I won, but because I had showed him the power and possibilities that jiu-jitsu gave you. This reinforced his belief that if I could beat King Zulu, he too was capable of anything. Later, Uncle Carlos said to me, "If you were able to do that at the worst possible biorhythmic time, imagine what you can do at your best." Kim was also impressed, because I think it was the first time she realized what it meant to be a Gracie. Once the celebrations were over, I had to face the fact that this was the toughest experience of my life, and that my father and brother were the keys to my victory. They had brought me back from a full panic attack. This also had made me realize how much I had to thank my family for. My measure of a brave man, a true fighter, is not how many times he gets knocked down, but how many times he gets back up. Even today, I am grateful to King Zulu for making me into a much better fighter. This fight exposed me to the most primal kind of fear that comes from within. My insecure state of mind came from the fear of losing. If you fear something that has not even happened, then quitting becomes a form of self-protection. Fear is not the enemy. It's simply a self-protection mechanism that must be managed. At the time, I was not confident enough to believe in myself unconditionally and was afraid of the unknown. It was a terrible feeling. Although my dad and brother pushed me through it, I reminded myself that doubts and an insecure state of mind would cripple me as a fighter. I realized that if I could control my mind, I could improve every aspect of my performance. If you have this kind of spiritual security, you realize that physicality is only one part of the puzzle. Everything had been theoretical up to now, but now I was faced with new realities. My first Vale Tudo fight taught me that sometimes you don't break physically, but emotionally. Although I was already physically and mentally confident, I wasn't spiritually and emotionally confident. If you don't have the spiritual connection, you can't dance on the razor's edge. I made a vow to myself that from that day forward, I would always try to cross the river, no matter the consequences. This made a huge difference, not just in my fighting career, but in the way I looked at life. Moving forward, if I committed to something, I was resigned to the outcome, no matter what it might be. I had always been looking for things that could help me grow as an athlete, but now I was truly hungry for this knowledge. I knew that if my dad and Holes hadn't been in my corner, I would have quit. If I was to become the greatest Gracie, I couldn't rely on others. I was the only one who would step into that ring, take on that responsibility, and uphold that honor. My mother, ever so patient, was always trying to find ways to give me peace of mind. First, she tried to get me into yoga, but I found the positions and postures painful and unnatural. Next, she took me to transcendental meditation, but when I chanted my mantra, I either fell asleep or couldn't concentrate well enough to do it. A gymnast friend, who knew a great deal about yoga, told me about a guy named Orlando Cani, who was developing a system of movement that one day would be called bioginástica. Cani's goal was to get people to move and breathe like animals in order to rediscover their natural instincts. Instead of being intelligent and rational, he wanted his students to become sensitive and intuitive. Orlando Cani believed that modern man had become disconnected from his body, because he had been taught to think instead of feel. Most people assume that there is a clear dividing line between the mind and body, but there isn't. The relationship is much more symbiotic and complex. He tried to reestablish the mind-body connection by making his students conscious of their everyday movements, things like getting out of bed, walking, and climbing ladders. This complex simplicity spoke to me because it was so much like jiu-jitsu. My first class was a basic group class that Orlando asked me to take so he could evaluate me. When I walked into his studio, I saw an altar with a Buddha on it, surrounded by some offerings. The floors were hardwood. There were mirrors on one side and floor-to-ceiling ladders on the other. My classmates were about a dozen men and women aged 25 to 50, regular people of all levels of fitness and coordination. Although Orlando Cani looked like a 1970s hippie yoga teacher, nothing could have been further from the truth. 2 decades my senior, he was a former paratrooper and one of the greatest athletes in Brazilian history. A champion swimmer, gymnast, runner, and marksman, Cani was also proficient in a number of martial arts. After he won his second world military pentathlon, the president of Brazil, Humberto Castelo Branco, awarded him the nation's highest athletic honor, the Sport Cross of Merit. After retiring from competition, he turned his full attention to Hatha Yoga and Pranayama breathing, and he traveled to India to study with Sri Yogendra, the father of modern yoga. When the class began, I was immediately impressed by Orlando Cani's agility and how well he moved for his age. We followed and tried to copy his movements as he talked to us and encouraged the class to relax, breathe, and empty our minds. He would say, "Imagine you are a bird. Move your arms." This was rhythmic and flowing, like dance and unlike yoga. I found it easy to slip into a more meditative state of mind. I wasn't thinking. I was just following Orlando and copying his movements. Toward the end of the class, he took me aside and said, "Hickson, you're special. I want to teach you privately because your ability level is so high." Connie's classes were not for everyone. You did not go to his studio to lose weight or to build muscles. Many students were confused by his commands because he would never say, "Do 10 more reps." Instead, he would say, "Extend your body's trunk, maintain neck posture, exhale, and let your internal energy flow. If you are moving and breathing, you can't have other thoughts in your head. You can't think, then move and breathe. It's not the same." He wanted to focus on the body's psychomotor system in order to develop fast, smooth, and explosive extension and flexibility. First, I learned the basic postures and the type of breathing that went with each one. Once I could do these correctly, he incorporated movement and martial arts animal forms. Ancient kung fu masters choreographed postures and movements based on the ways different animals move and fight. The tiger combines strength with mobility and attacks forcefully and directly. The crane is evasive, graceful, and relies on its long neck and sharp beak for both offense and defense. The snake is fast, agile, and deceptive, and can both strike and strangle. Orlando liked us to try to emulate different animals because they use their strength and flexibility naturally. In a relatively short time, I was able to combine breathing with fast movement and enter into a meditative state. One day, Orlando Cani started class and the phone rang. He had to take the call and told me to continue without him. For the first time, I was not playing follow the leader. I started to breathe and move and breathe and move and quickly got lost in the motion. I was jumping from ladder to ladder like a monkey. At one point, I almost felt that I could fly. All of my movements, whether standing, climbing, or on the ground, were flowing, and my transitions were seamless. I was completely unconscious. When I came back to my senses, I was on the highest rung on the ladder, dripping with sweat. I looked around and saw Orlando Cani in the corner, crying. I asked my teacher what was going on. He said, "I have nothing left to teach you." I asked him how he could say that, and he said, "I've been watching you for the last hour and 10 minutes. I called to you a few times, and you didn't hear me. You kept moving. You were in a total meditative state. Your brain and consciousness were completely turned off." It was an emotional moment for both of us. Whenever I entered this empty mind state, I could neither hear nor talk and was not conscious of my movements. Not only did my mind go blank, but afterward I felt as if my brain had been cleaned and reset. This gave me the ability to retreat from my own consciousness and come back stronger. I noticed the effects immediately. I was able to focus with absolute clarity, and my senses grew sharper, as did my awareness of my body and surroundings. By far the most important thing that Orlando Cani taught me was how to control my breathing. You can go weeks without food and days without water, but 5 minutes without air and you're dead. Think about that for a minute. These breathing techniques would become especially important in the coming years because they made it much easier for me to gauge and control fear, adrenaline, panic, and claustrophobia. For example, if I want to control my adrenaline when I'm nervous, I breathe at a slower pace until I get my emotions under control. If I want to increase my pace, I don't use my mind to tell my body to speed up. I just breathe deeper and faster. During high exertion, exhaling becomes more important than inhaling. To enjoy a good deep breath, you must consciously empty your lungs. When I breathe with my belly, I get more oxygen and expel more carbon dioxide. Not knowing how to breathe is like having a hand and not knowing how to use your fingers. Most people are chest breathers, meaning that their stomach does not move when they breathe because they don't use their diaphragm, only the upper part of their lungs. If you breathe from your chest, the breaths are short and panicky. One of the most important muscles for high-performance athletes to develop in order to breathe more efficiently is the diaphragm. Cani realized that a person breathing normally uses less than 50% of the lung's capacity. So he applied pranayama techniques to athletics and was able to utilize 80% of the lung's capacity. This conscious approach to breathing is just like using the different gears of a car's transmission. Flutists, opera singers, snipers, divers, and big wave surfers all understand the importance of breathing. Today you hear the top tennis pros screaming, "Ah!" when they hit the ball, because they know that the forceful exhalation gives them speed and more explosive power. Everything I have earned today was at least partially a result of breathing. My best performance, my emotional control, my ability to endure. Breathing gave me all of this. Once I started to learn the mechanics of breathing and how to apply them, my sprint became twice as long as my opponent's sprint, yet my recovery time was 3 to 4 times faster. I learned that if my opponent's heart rate was at 80 to 90 beats per minute, BPM, and mine was 60, in no time he would be at 120 BPM, while I'd be only at 90. Soon he'd be at 150, and I'd still only be at 100 BPM. That was when his panic would set in, when he realized that he needed a break and I didn't. Orlando Cani taught me how to empty my mind and use intuition instead of my brain. After training with him, my perception improved to the point where I could shake someone's hand and instantly determine if he was friend or foe, relaxed or tense, happy or sad, confident or insecure. This gave me a huge advantage in the ring. When I fought, I was neither emotional nor intellectual. I never thought about strategy. I just allowed myself to connect with my opponent on a profound level. The moment the bell rang, I didn't expect anything or plan anything. In order to do this, I had to rid myself of all thoughts about victory or defeat. Anything I didn't need for that specific fight against that specific opponent went on the shelf. I soon field-tested these principles on the mat and in the ring. I would learn to bring my fights to a boiling point, and when my opponent needed to rest, I would turn up the heat and go for the kill. With the exception of my father, Elio, and my brother, Holes, Orlando Cani was the most important teacher of my life. He helped me to see fighting through a more spiritual and emotional lens. Once I could accept death and walk comfortably toward it, what was there to be afraid of? My biggest personal breakthrough came after realizing that my life was less important than my mission. I was always courageous, but would often waste my courage on stupid things that put me at unnecessary risk. For example, I was fine with risking my life in Big Surf because I felt that it helped me grow. but going to a party and getting into a fight now seemed stupid and even reckless. I wanted to calculate my risks and save them for things that would advance my mission to become the greatest Gracie. While I admired the soccer player Pelé, the swimmer Mark Spitz, and a handful of other great athletes, I was inspired most by the greatest Brazilian race car driver of all time, Ayrton Senna. We were roughly the same age, and there were many similarities in our training methodology and outlook on competition. We both believed that the harder you trained, the easier you raced or fought. When Senna's races were canceled due to rain, he would take his car out and practice in the worst possible conditions. In 1984, during his rookie season, the Monaco Grand Prix was held in a massive rainstorm. World champions were spinning out and crashing, but Senna, an unknown rookie in a shitty car, drove better and faster than all of them. He once said that when he was driving a car at the limit of its performance envelope, he was not conscious of driving. That was exactly how I felt when I was fighting. I don't think it's a coincidence that Ayrton Senna was also a selfless and deeply spiritual man. Even though he was notoriously competitive, he also had great compassion. During a practice session for the 1992 Belgian Grand Prix, French driver Eric Comas crashed into a barrier at 200 miles per hour and was knocked unconscious. When Senna drove up to the crash, he could hear the Frenchman's engine revving at red line and realized that Comas's foot was still on the accelerator of the crashed car and that it could burst into flames at any moment. Without a second's hesitation, Senna stopped in the middle of the track, jumped out of his car, sprinted over to Comas, shut down the motor, and stabilized the driver's neck until the ambulance arrived. I was sad, but not surprised, when Senna died on the racetrack in 1994. He had been operating on the razor's edge for quite some time by then. After training with Orlando, I was willing to fight anyone under any rules. I didn't care if he was 200 pounds heavier than me. It was a particular kind of suicide, but I was willing to sacrifice my body to achieve my larger mission. Now I visualized my worst nightmares with spiritual comfort, not fear. If I had to die in the process, well, fuck, then die I had to. In addition to the mental advances that I was making, my relationship with Kim had gotten serious, and this marked a big step forward for me in my relationships with women. I didn't see Kim as just another girl. I wanted to have a relationship with her because I felt like I had met my mate. She was independent, strong, beautiful, and had a good sense of humor. And Kim was not a party girl who had to have perfect clothes and makeup all the time. She could surf and spend the day at the beach. Kim liked great restaurants, but she was also content with simple things, like eating a good meal at home. For a time, we really complimented each other and were living the dream. I gave her a sense of security that she had never had, and she encouraged me to think big. She was everything I wanted in a woman, and I felt that I had met my perfect match. I was ecstatic when Kim got pregnant with our first son, Hokson. Though we weren't planning on having kids so soon, I knew that she loved me and that she knew how important family was to me. I had no conception of life without one. For her, it was more difficult because she was a model and a pro surfer. A child would have a big impact on her career aspirations. Nonetheless, Kim's pregnancy was a beautiful time in our lives. When Kim went into labor, we went to a small clinic in Rio for her to give birth. Her labor was long, and I was standing behind her when Hokson squirmed into the doctor's hands. When I saw his dick, it was the happiest day of my life. I loved that baby more than I loved myself. 14 hours later, the three of us were home at our apartment, and I was starting a new chapter in my life. Hokson was not an easy baby. He didn't sleep much, and he cried all the time. When we got home from the hospital, I was up all night with him so Kim could recover. My son was born on Tuesday, and I went Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday without sleeping much or training. That Sunday, however, I was in the finals of a jiu-jitsu competition against Sergio Peña. At that time, Peña was the latest jiu-jitsu phenom who had won everything and skyrocketed to the top of the food chain. This tournament took place on two consecutive weekends, and I had already defeated him the previous weekend. Initially, I was going to fight in the middleweight division, but when I saw that Pena was a heavyweight, I told the tournament organizer, "Let's make this a real party. Put me in the heavyweight division." On the first Sunday, we faced off in the heavyweight division, and I made him tap after catching him in an armlock. He had not been finished that quickly in many years and was out for revenge when we met in the open division finals the next Sunday. When our fight started and we engaged, I felt weak and my recovery was off. I pretended to fight, but was really just conserving my energy for one opportunity. When we went to the ground, Sergio passed my guard, which made the crowd go crazy. I was down by 7 or 8 points in a matter of seconds. I pretended to be dead and let my opponent gain confidence. The crowd thought that they were about to witness the greatest upset in jiu-jitsu history. People wanted to see the underdog win and were screaming, "Believe, Sergio! Courage, Sergio!" Toward the end of the fight, Sergio was ahead on points, 15-0. I turned to Holes and asked, "How much time?" When he said 2 minutes, I knew that it was now or never. I pulled guard, and when he tried to pass, I reversed him, took the side, mounted, and put him in a collar choke. Sergio was a valiant guy. He didn't tap, and I put him to sleep with 45 seconds remaining. Jiu-jitsu tournaments were getting less and less interesting to me. Hokusan's birth forced me to look beyond jiu-jitsu and think about what kind of family I wanted, as well as to take a harder look at the one I was born into. Elio was almost 70 when Hokusan was born, and his mindset was still straight out of the 1950s. He didn't care if his grandsons were educated or polite, so long as they were good soldiers for his army. Elio would always acknowledge Carlos Gracie, the clan, and the universe, but he could never recognize my mother for the support that she gave him. Growing up, I felt that my mother was always sad. Sometimes I would find her crying and ask, "Mother, what's wrong?" Even though she would always say that nothing was, I realized that she was quietly suffering. I saw how much she sacrificed for my father and her kids, and how little my dad reciprocated or even acknowledged it. Can you imagine being married to Elio Gracie? While there were many things I liked about the Gracie traditions, polygamy was not one of them. Uncle Carlos and Elio were not the first polygamous Gracies. Their father, Gastão, had 5 children with another woman while he was married to my grandmother. I was about 13 when my father asked me, "Would you like to have more brothers?" I said yes, and he told me to get in the car. We drove to an apartment building in Botafogo, about 10 minutes away, and took the elevator to the 6th floor. Elio knocked on one of the doors. It was cracked open, and Vera, a woman who worked at the academy, stuck her head out the top. Then one little head popped out the bottom of the crack and smiled at me, then another, and then another. "They're all your brothers," my dad said. That was the first time I met my brothers Holker, Hoyler, and Hoyce. The kids were cute and friendly, but as much as I liked them, I couldn't help but feel sorry for my mom. My father never told her that he wanted more children. He just showed up one day with 4 more. At first, Mom was depressed, but eventually Elio convinced her to become friends with Vera. Although my mother pretended to move on, I could see how much this hurt her. Once I became a parent, I saw that my dad and Uncle Carlos were dinosaurs, that their outlook and their relationships were all static and frozen in time. This tempered my admiration for them, and I didn't want to be that way. My wife, Kim, supported me wholeheartedly, and I recognized that without her help, I would not have made it as far as I did. I saw the sacrifices she made for me, how she was always willing to put me first and herself second. My dad would never have appreciated his wife like that. He didn't give a fuck about how my mother felt. In Elio Gracie's mind, his mission was bigger than these kinds of sensitivities. The year 1982 was a bittersweet one. I was now the father of the son I had always dreamed of, but I also suffered a devastating loss. In June, Holes and his family went to Maui for a family weekend in the mountains. Holes noticed that his old hang glider was strapped to the roof of a car in front of his hotel. It turned out that the owner was a friend of a friend. Even though my brother had promised his wife, Angela, that he would quit hang gliding after he had several close calls and friends had died in accidents, he made arrangements to go the next day. The following day, the conditions were very bad because there was no wind. If Holes got his mind set on something, however, there was no saying no to him. Although the owner of his old hang glider did not want to go because he thought it was too dangerous, Holes talked him into letting him use it for just one flight. My brother ran down the ramp, launched, initially got some lift, but then began to spiral, and he hit the ground 90 yards from the ramp. His friend ran into the overgrown forest and found my brother hanging upside down with his eyes wide open. Although he looked perfectly fine, his neck was broken, and Holes was dead. I received the news over the phone, and it took only seconds to know that my life would never be the same. Not only had I lost an idol, a teacher, and my favorite brother, but I was now the official family champion. Now I would have to answer all the challenges and lead the next generation of Gracie fighters. I was now my family's last line of defense. Holes's funeral was held in a cemetery near downtown. All of our family was there, except for Uncle Carlos, who was too devastated to attend. Inside the casket, Holes was dressed in a T-shirt and looked normal except for his neck, which was very swollen. Sadly, this was my very last image of him. I missed him then, and I still miss him today. His death affected our family dynamics dramatically. Holes had brought the two sides together because he was Carlos's son, but was raised by Elio. He had acted as a bridge between the two sides of the family, but now that bridge was gone forever. Chapter 5. Steel Sharpens Steel. The first significant split in the family came when it was time for Holes's widow, Angela, to decide who would take over his academy. Although my father wanted it, she gave it to Holes's brother Carlos Jr. instead, and he would soon emerge as my father's biggest jiu-jitsu rival. While Elio was content to continue teaching jiu-jitsu as a self-defense martial art, Carlos Jr. had big ideas about how to transform it into a competitive sport with standardized rules, sponsors, and officially sanctioned tournaments with referees and time limits. After my fight with King Zulu, I was growing less interested in jiu-jitsu and more so in Vale Tudo. In 1983, the media conglomerate Grupo Globo was trying to promote the South American Boxing Championship at the Maracanazinho Gymnasium in Rio. They included one Vale Tudo fight and announced that King Zulu was coming down from the north and issuing a challenge to Rio's fighters. This was a big deal because Vale Tudo fights had been banned in Rio for decades. At first, I wasn't that interested in fighting King Zulu because I had already beaten him. Above all, I was curious to see who would step up and accept the challenge. I was hoping that a tough luta libre fighter like Denilson Maia or a kickboxer like Flavio Molina might answer the call. Someone had to defend Rio's honor, and there were plenty of fighters who could. I figured that it was just a matter of time before one of them announced that he was fighting Zulu. 3 weeks later, silence. Not one fighter from Rio stepped forward. It was like a giant swell had hit the coast, and everyone was pretending that there were no waves because they were afraid to paddle out. I understand why most fighters at the time were scared. Vale Tudo was unknown territory. A Vale Tudo match is not a jiu-jitsu tournament or a kickboxing bout. Those who fight 10-minute rounds without gloves, mouthpiece, or cup, win or lose, will leave their comfort zone. Finally, the promoters came directly to me and asked me to fight King Zulu again for the princely sum of maybe $5,000. After I accepted the challenge, the event sold out the 17,000-seat stadium. This time, I had a home court advantage, because the fight would be at Maracanazinho Gymnasium, where my father had fought Kimura, and all of my friends, family, and students would be there. The night of the fight, The stadium was packed with a very loud and rowdy crowd. In our first fight, King Zulu was reckless because he didn't fear or respect me. In our second fight, he was much more careful and did not charge me when the bell rang. When we finally connected in a clinch, he picked me up and slammed me, but wound up in my guard. Thanks to Orlando Cani, mentally I was a different fighter now. In this fight, I was confident and prepared, and my body was on autopilot. At a certain point, a fight becomes a transcendental experience. It was as if I was in the wheelhouse of a ship at sea, looking out of a porthole at the chaos of a stormy sea all around me. I had been here before, and my body needed no instructions. Even with King Zulu inside my guard, trying to headbutt me and gouge my eyes, I was totally calm. This time, I felt that my opponent was fighting much more cautiously, and it would take me time to cook him down. I stayed on my back, made sure to control his head, and heel-kicked him over and over in the kidneys and floating ribs. He survived the first round by staying calm inside my guard and didn't make a mistake. I was in no hurry. I knew that King Zulu was burning far more energy than I was. It was so loud when the second round began that I could not hear the bell. Meanwhile, King Zulu was trying to get inside of my head by filling his cheeks with air, making faces at me, and jumping around the ring. I still was not sure if the round had started, so I turned to the referee and held both of my thumbs up. When he nodded yes, I attacked. We clinched and went to the ground. He tried to grab my neck, but I was able to slip out of his hold and take his back. As I began to sink my choke, I felt my opponent's gigantic fingers crawling around on my face, trying to find an eye to gouge, but it was too late, and I submitted him with a choke. King Zulu never got exhausted, as he did in our first fight. He just made that one mistake. What would have stressed me before I trained with Orlando Cani was now child's play. My potential was not growing a little bit. It was growing by leaps and bounds. I now felt as though I had a reserve parachute that nobody else had, and I was ready for anything. Winning the rematch with Zulu in Rio established me as the Vale Tudo champion to beat. Not much changed in my day-to-day life. I kept teaching, training, competing in jiu-jitsu, and raising my son. I was convinced that he was going to be just like me. Even as a tiny child, Hokusan was intense, incredibly coordinated, focused, and nimble. As he grew, I tried to make him as athletic and fearless as possible. I threw him into the air as my father had done with me, and then bought him a trampoline that he would bounce on for hours. I also encouraged him to hang on ropes for as long as possible. At 21, I was a young father, and I gave Hokusan everything a boy could ever want. For example, when he was just a small child, I bought him a brand new surfboard. Today I would say, if you want that surfboard, you have to be nicer to your mother. You have to put your clothes in the drawer and peel all the apples for a week, and then I will get you one. Many years later, I realized that things mean more if you earn them. But when I was young and wanted to give him a present, I didn't think twice. Hokusan's birth did not change the way I led my day-to-day life. I left our apartment at 7 in the morning and taught and trained until 10 at night. I could still go to the beach in the middle of the day and surf with my friends and do many other things that my wife could no longer do. Kim began to get frustrated, and for the first time, some friction began to enter our relationship. Children alter the course of a relationship because the focus is no longer on the two partners. I was young and craved the passion with Kim that we once had. I started to drift away and have casual affairs with other women. I never disrespected Kim by rubbing her face in it, but she had a sixth sense and knew something was up. She began to grow colder toward me, and I grew more distant as a result. Still, we both loved Hokusan and remained united in our mission to raise him. I had another distraction when the Luta Libre challenges began. Luta Libre is a no-gi style of grappling and Vale Tudo fighting that had been around for many years. A wrestler named Euclides Tatu Hatem created the style in the 1920s, and fought my Uncle George in the 1940s. By the 1980s, tattoo student Fausto Bruno Silla and his son Carlos had taken over and had a number of tough students, like Marco Ruas, Hugo Duarte, and Eugenio Tadeu, who would go on to make names for themselves in the early years of MMA. Although the Lucha Libre fighters had been our rivals for decades, things between us had escalated before Holes died, when a karate fighter sucker-punched one of my younger cousins on the street. My cousin was just a kid, and the other guy was an adult. When Holes heard about this, he went straight down to his teacher Flavio Molina's Ninja Academy, and a huge brawl broke out. After that, Molina, who was one of Brazil's first Thai boxers, started to practice grappling with the Luta Livre fighters to be better prepared against jiu-jitsu fighters. Rather than brawl in the street, we decided to settle the score in the ring with a Vale Tudo tournament between jiu-jitsu and Luta Livre. Jiu-jitsu was represented by my students Marcelo Bering, Fernando Pinduca, and Renan Pitengai. Representing Luta Livre were Marco Ruas, Eugenio Tadeu, and Flavio Molina. The fights were very tough, and in the end, jiu-jitsu won one, lost one, and tied one. The Luta Livre guys were happy with their performance. By cross-training with kickboxers like Molina, some of the Luta Livre fighters were beginning to feel and act as if they had figured out a formula to beat jiu-jitsu. Although my and Kim's relationship remained tense, she got pregnant again and had our second child in 1984, a beautiful baby girl we named Cao Wan. Unlike Hokson, who was intense, Cao Wan was peaceful and happy. She smiled constantly and was strong, steady, and calm like a little Buddha. Everybody wanted to hold her and hug her. She loved Hokson and looked up to him, but was not as coordinated as he. Cao Wan would try to emulate him. Her spirit was willing. But we had to watch out for her because she would sometimes hurt herself trying to keep up with him. Cao Wan's real gifts were artistic. She loved music, singing, and dancing. Anytime we put music on, she would start to dance. Though Cao Wan was a very positive addition to our family, Kim's resentment of me continued to grow. Now she had two small children to take care of, and I still had not changed my ways. I was gone training and teaching most of the time. As much as she loved our children, motherhood was a hard transition for her. In the blink of an eye, she had gone from a model with the world at her feet to a mother at home with two babies. While I am not proud of it today, truth be told, I was young, famous, and selfish. The most beautiful women in Rio were throwing themselves at me, and the fact that I did not always resist the temptations did not help matters. Whatever happened between Kim and me, I was never going to leave my children in the wind. They were too important. In order for me to be happy, I had to be with my kids. I wanted to teach them about respect and honesty. What if Kim remarried a guy who drank, smoked, and was a bad influence on them? Despite my failings as a husband and our fighting, I knew that Kim loved our kids more than anything and took very good care of them. We still loved each other and tried to make our marriage work, but I had a limited and unusual frame of reference when it came to women and relationships. Carlos and Elio Gracie were not exactly sensitive New Age guys, and some of their attitude had obviously rubbed off on me. In 1986, Kim gave birth to our third child, a second daughter we named Kaolin, who was more like Hookson than her older sister. Even though she was shy, Kaolin was curious and not afraid of anything. She was a warrior who imposed her will and did things her way. Despite the strains in our marriage, my children brought me great joy. When American fashion photographer Bruce Weber came to Rio to take pictures of Brazilian athletes in 1986, he heard about me. After we met at his hotel and talked for a while, he became fascinated by my family and interested in our history and traditions. The way that Bruce works is informal and very intimate. Because he wanted to understand me, he went to the beach with us, ate meals with us, and closely observed how we lived and raised our kids. His photographs brought us to life because they showed that, although I was one of the toughest people on earth, I was still a human, playful, gentle, and caring with my children. Bruce intuitively understood the complexity of my life and personality. We became friends and still are to this day. Not only did Bruce Weber take some beautiful pictures, but he was really the first person to introduce me to an international audience. It was not hard for us to pretend to be the perfect family. Kim and our children were beautiful. I was a successful athlete, and from the outside, our family looked ideal. The truth was less kind. The Gracie clan continued to divide along bloodlines. While Horian was trying to establish our martial art in the United States, Carlos Gracie Jr. was going in a different direction in Brazil and primarily focusing on a competitive form of jiu-jitsu that would come to be known as sport jiu-jitsu. Carlos was a smart and creative guy, but behind closed doors, he and I always argued. He thought that because the Gracie family was already famous, all we needed to do was maintain our reputation. Carlos always wanted to lead, but never did the kind of heavy lifting that I did. I didn't inherit the title of family champion. I earned it with blood, sweat, and tears. Carlos deserves much of the credit for creating sports jiu-jitsu, but with it came a problem. It transformed our martial art and created a lot of paper tigers who would never step into the ring to carry the flag of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. My father didn't like the sport version because he thought that it was watering down our martial art. Elio used to say, "This is not my jiu-jitsu, because competitive jiu-jitsu is not a martial art. The jiu-jitsu I created is a martial art, so a person can defend themselves on the street without getting beaten up." Just how much things were changing became clear to me during one of my last big tournaments in Rio in 1986. I was surprised to see that Carlos Gracie Jr. had my cousins Higan Machado and Jean-Jacques Machado listed as his students. I had not trained with the Machado brothers in a while, but they were also my students. Higan was a big, skilled black belt who had won the Brazilian National Championship every year at every belt. Like me, Higan had not lost a tournament match since he was 14. I was even more surprised when Carlos claimed that the sponsor demanded a match between me and my cousin. I didn't believe him. Higan was Carlos's first black belt and one of the family's rising stars. If he beat me, he would be the new king of Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. The sponsorship thing was bullshit. Carlos had been whispering in Higan's ear, "Imagine if you win. You'll be the new family champion." When Carlos told me about the match, I told him, "Carlos, you're making a mistake by having me fight Higan and breaking our family alliance over a fucking sponsor." I hadn't trained with the Machado brothers in a while. Maybe Higan thought that he could beat me now, so I warned both of them that if we fought, I would not hold back. When we faced off in the open class final, we engaged, and Higan threw me hard onto the mat. I recovered, swept him, and we went back and forth at full speed. Both of us had our gas pedals floored, and although my cousin was bigger, I knew that he could not keep pace with me. With 3 minutes left, he was exhausted by the pace and intensity, and I caught him in a choke. After the fight, Higan came to me and said, "Fighting you was the worst mistake I've ever made in my life. I never want to fight you again. I did this because Carlos asked me to." "No problem. Let's forget about it." I had little interest in the politics of jiu-jitsu, and I had 3 children to support. I wanted to fight Vale Tudo professionally, and the only place to do it outside of Brazil was Japan. Fighting in Japan was not that simple, because the Yakuza, the powerful Japanese organized crime syndicates, were heavily involved in almost all of the fight promotions. Worse, many of the fighters were pro wrestlers, and although they were large, strong, and skilled, many of their fights were works or fixed fights. I refused to do fixed fights. I traveled to Japan with my friend and informal advisor, Sergio Zeveter, for the first time in 1987, with a letter of introduction to Antonio Inoki, a former wrestler who had fought a demonstration bout with Muhammad Ali in 1976. By now, he had retired from the ring and had become one of Japan's most powerful fight promoters. Even before I went there, Japan had always been a part of my life. Jiu-jitsu is Japanese, and I knew that my uncle had learned it from a Japanese fighter and heard about my dad's fights against Japanese fighters. I don't believe in coincidences and think the connection is much deeper than that. Why was my dad the most prominent jiu-jitsu fighter and teacher in Brazil? Why did generation after generation of my family learn jiu-jitsu and fight to prove its efficiency and superiority? When I was a young boy, I even had dreams in which I spoke fluent Japanese. I understood what I was saying, and even remember having an argument in one of them. However, when I woke up in Rio, I could no longer understand the language. Inoki would not see me immediately, so while I was waiting, I explored Tokyo. First, I went to the Kodokan, the world's most famous judo school, to pay my respects. This was where judo's inventor and founder, Jigoro Kano, taught Hideo Maeda, who in turn taught my uncles. I felt obliged to go there, given what Maeda had done for my family. Although the Kodokan's judo masters welcomed me with open arms, when I told them that I was in Japan to set up a pro fight, they politely told me that I could not train there. Jigoro Kano did not allow prize fighting. After much waiting and even more formalities, Inoki refused to meet with me. In the end, his organization wanted me to be one of their stable fighters, like a pro wrestler. To him, I probably looked like just another unknown fighter looking for his big break. Even though the trip seemed like a waste of time, it taught me things about Japan that would help me in the coming years. First, I learned how structured a society it was and how rules and hierarchies were respected more than anything else. Second, I learned the importance of unquestioning obedience. The number two man never questions the number one man, no matter how wrong he is. To me, following someone who you knew was wrong was beyond reason or honor. It was just blind obedience. This also made me reevaluate my view of the samurai. According to the samurai code of Bushido, the code of the warrior, honor and loyalty were more important than wealth, life, and family. On the battlefield, the samurai had absolute loyalty and courage and were great warriors, but they did not fight for themselves. The samurai were servants from their first day to their last, because they were bound by honor to stick with their master. The word samurai actually means one who serves, and his only dreams and ambitions were to be those of his shogun. After I failed to get a fight in Japan, I returned to Brazil, and my dad began trying to convince me to move to California to help Horion promote Gracie Jiu-Jitsu there. My dad convinced me that Horion needed the best Gracies in the U.S. to help him spread the martial art. This made sense to me, but I didn't want to leave my family behind. Things at home grew even more strained when Kim got pregnant with our fourth child. It was a very difficult pregnancy. She had to remain in bed for most of it, or she risked losing the baby. One day, Kim exploded at me, and all of her resentment for me and her present situation boiled over. After she said some harsh things to me in the heat of the moment, I said, "If you're not happy with me here, I'm going to live at my friend's house. I'll come by to see the kids and will give you all the support you need." Even though I regained my freedom, now that I had kids, it didn't feel the same. When my second son, Kron, was born, Kim and I were still separated. Kron was a calm baby, completely different from Hokson. He smiled all the time and had a very good sense of humor. We called him Bozinho, which means a good one in Portuguese. The girls smothered him with affection, but Kim was adamant that my relationship with him was not going to be like my relationship with Hokson. Even at 7 years old, Hokson was my right-hand man and went everywhere with me. He was already intent on being a Gracie and a fighter. Once people heard that I was leaving for America, a rumor started to circulate that Marco Ruas, one of Lucha Libre's best fighters, who would go on to become a UFC champion, wanted to fight me. I could not officially challenge Ruas, because I was the champion and an established name, and Ruas had only fought my student to a draw. While I didn't want to challenge him, I needed to show that I was willing to fight him anytime, anywhere. One evening, my father, Marcelo Bering, Sergio Zaveter, and I drove over to the Lucha Libre Academy. We walked in, and 20 or 30 fighters stopped training and stared at us. Marco Ruas walked over and greeted us. Everyone was very respectful, at first. I told Ruas that I heard he wanted to fight me, and I was there to fight him. He said that he wanted to fight, but that he would need 4 months to prepare. This made me feel that he was more interested in capitalizing on the fight than proving himself, which pissed me off. I was the one who walked into that lion's den, ready and willing to fight, for nothing but honor. It started to get heated, and my dad stepped between us to calm things down. When Elio offered to make a list so I could fight everyone in one day, I angrily told my dad that this was not a street lottery. The situation continued to deteriorate as tempers rose, and I told them to contact us when they were ready to fight. Just as we were leaving, Hugo Duarte, an unknown at the time, who was standing behind Ruas, said, "You can put me at the top of that list." I could see in Hugo's eyes that he wanted to fight me, that he was serious. I'd gone to the Lucha Libre Academy to fight Marco Ruas, an accomplished, reputable fighter, and now I was getting pressured into fighting an upstart. I couldn't challenge a nobody, so I had a friend tell Hugo to meet me at Pepe Beach on Saturday. I got sick the week of the fight and was thinking about postponing it until my messenger called and said, "It's all set. Hugo will be there on Saturday." Now I knew that there was no backing out, so I started to eat well and get ready. About 40 guys assembled at the Gracie Barra Academy on Saturday morning. I wanted to make sure that this would be a one-on-one fight, so I was giving everyone his instructions. I told my cousin Jean-Jacques Machado to watch my back, because I would be surrounded by fighters from both sides. Then my cousin Carlos Gracie Jr. asked me if this fight was worth it. He said, "You have everything to lose and nothing to win." It's one thing to question my decision weeks or even days before a fight, but it's quite another to do so on the day of the fight, let alone minutes before it. There were Gracies like my father and brother Holes, who were always in the front line, and there were others who were not. All the Gracies of our generation learned the martial art and shared the same ideology, but not all became great fighters. Because I fought and beat the Hawaiian and Zulu, I became Hickson Gracie. I was no longer just Elio Gracie's son. Yes, I had the name, but if I had not fought and won these bouts, that would have been all that I had. I told Carlos that it was better for me to fight Hugo now, because if I didn't, nobody else would. "The time for thinking is over, my brother," I told him. "Now it is time to do it." A tense silence fell over the Gracie Barra Academy that was broken by my son, Hookson, who was only 7. "And if he brings his son, I'm going to kick his ass, too." Everybody laughed, which lightened the mood, until someone opened the door and yelled, "The Lucha Libre guys are down at Pepe Beach." At that time, I had no reservations about bringing my son to this fight. After all, this was our family business, and there were times when a message needed to be sent. We left as a group, and when we got to Pepe Beach, Hugo was there, supported by Eugenio Tadeu and many of the top Lucha Libre fighters. We both knew why we were there, so I walked up to Hugo and slapped him in the face. He took off his shirt and sandals, and we began to wrestle on our feet until I was able to drag him to the ground. Hugo used my ponytail to control my head and stood back up. He fell on top of me, then I swept him, but my knee got buried in the sand and Hugo escaped. We stood back up again and smashed into a vendor stand and went down to the ground again. With the crowd surging all around us, I mounted again, gift-wrapped him, and began to punch him in the face at will. There was nothing he could do to stop the punches. When I asked Ugo if he wanted to give up, he said, "You'll have to kill me." So I kept blasting him with punches and elbows. After more blows to the face, he changed his mind, and when he said, "Okay, stop," I let him go. We stood up and walked to the ocean to wash off the blood and sand. Ugo turned to me and said, "I'm not happy. I was winning until your relative started kicking me on the ground and throwing sand in my eyes. Typical Gracie bullshit." "Okay, let's keep fighting then," I replied. When Ugo said, "No, but we'll meet again," I knew that this was not over. By the time we got out of the water, Henzo, Hoyler, and others were skirmishing with Luta Livre fighters. Although the fights got broken up, Hoyler would fight Eugenio in the coming weeks. A week later, I was sleeping when my friend pulled up in front of the apartment on his motorcycle and screamed, "Hickson, those motherfuckers invaded your dad's academy!" I ran down the stairs as fast as I could and jumped on his bike in my underwear. The street that the school was on was filled with people blocking traffic, and the cars and buses were violently honking their horns. We forced our way through the crowd to get to the stairs to the academy, just as my dad, Ugo Duarte, Eugenio Tadeo, and Denilson Maya, the head of the Luta Livre, were coming down. My dad was calm as usual and kept the situation under control. I saw Ugo and noticed that he was sweaty, already warmed up. We walked over to the concrete patio, where many of the guys with him had T-shirts covering their faces. Some had guns, others had knives and broken bottles. These were gangsters, not fighters who lived according to a code. I walked over to Ugo and told him that I wanted to talk to him before we fought. My dad, Ugo, and his teacher, Denilson Maya, went along with me to the backyard. "Ugo," I said, "I respect the fact that you came here for revenge. I have no problem with that. I'm here to fight you. But this is different than the last fight, because the last time we fought, it was just fighters. Some of these motherfuckers you brought today have no code. Let me tell you one thing. If anyone jumps into this fight before it's over, I will take it very personally." Ugo said, "No, just you and me." I nodded and said, "Okay then, let's do it." We walked back to the crowd on the patio and squared off. I immediately sensed that Ugo wanted to punch me, so I baited him into throwing a punch. When he did, I deflected it, clinched, and threw him hard onto his back on the concrete. I mounted and started punching him. Ugo covered up to defend his face, but I started banging his head on a stair. He moved his hands to stop me, and I punched him in the face. Ugo yelled, "Stop! Stop!" I stopped hitting him and stood up. "You're a tough guy," I said. "You have a bright future as a fighter. Is this matter settled once and for all?" "Yes," Ugo replied, and I believed him. Just as we were shaking hands, my younger brother Hoyler started to fight with Eugenio Tadeu. As we all turned our attention to their fight, a police car pulled up. The cops couldn't get through the crowd, so one of them shot his handgun in the air. Still, nobody moved. Then the first cop's partner, a scrawny guy with a thick mustache, blasted his automatic rifle, a bullet from which ricocheted off a building and hit someone in the leg. Finally, Hoyler and Eugenio stopped fighting, and the crowd scattered. As people tried to get away, the little cop walked to the center of the patio, smiled, and yelled, "Who's the tough guy now?" I thought it funny that the smallest cop was not afraid of anything. It was tragic that it was his gun that put him above the fray. A few days later, Hoyler and Eugenio fought to a 38-minute draw. Looking back today on the fights between jiu-jitsu and Luta Livre, I see them very differently. At the time, we were all young men full of aggression and testosterone. The rivalry between our two martial arts made all of us better fighters. Steel sharpens steel. We should all be grateful for the fact that we always had the ability to fight one another respectfully. Although there were black eyes, bloody noses, and broken teeth, our fights were always one-on-one and were governed by honor and mutual respect. It was part of the natural competitive process. It was no accident that Marco Ruas, Ugo Duarte, Denilson Maya, Eugenio Tadeu, my brothers, some of my cousins, and I would all go on to fight mixed martial arts professionally in America and Japan. Chapter 6. Coming to America. There was little left for me to prove in Brazil at that point. America was a bigger stage with more opportunities, and I thought my kids would have a brighter future there. When I decided to move to the U.S., Kim and I had been separated for over a year and a half. I went to see her and told her that I would like her to come with me and the kids and give our relationship another chance. She agreed to my offer. I wanted to make a fresh start. I had been to the United States many times, but had never lived